Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to part two of The Ant Hill Kids, one of the most disturbing tales of a cult in Canada. Let's go ahead and get right into part two, as there's still plenty of story left to cover. All right, so when we left off in part one, Rock Terrio had just been released from prison in Quebec and rejoined his group, and to their dismay, Rock was again determined to move everyone back into the wilderness and away from what he said was modern society. But I think we can all look back now and figure out that he was looking to run from the Quebec authorities, who were now more than familiar with him and any other prying eyes that would attempt to disturb Rock and his followers. The phone rang just a few days after Rock and Jacques had departed, heading west. Giselle picked up, and on the other line was Rock Terrio. "Mammy, you won't believe the good news." Giselle responded by guessing that they had found a new house for them. Rock replied, stating that they had purchased an entire forest. Giselle was disappointed by this, as she had become accustomed to the creature comforts of living indoors again. But 2 hours later, Giselle was packing up her things and off to build another commune from scratch. As they arrived at their new parcel of land near Burnt River, Ontario, they set up their tents as they battled the swarms of bugs. The process of building their new haven was no different than it was in Quebec. It was months of backbreaking work in the elements. This time, their commune consisted of an A-frame cabin, another two-story house, a bakery, a smokehouse, a sugar shack, and a root cellar. But Rock's pride and joy was his private sanctuary, which was simply a column of stones 4 feet high at the base of a cedar tree where he claimed to commune with God. Rock also assigned everyone roles that went alongside his perceived hierarchy within the group. Solange had recently risen in the ranks to be the most important to Rock, so she was tasked with the bookkeeping, making sure all the chores were being done, and was the one who settled any disputes between cult members. Giselle was the surrogate mother to all the other wives and grandmother to the growing number of children. Chantel was Rock's personal chef and washed and laid out his clothes daily for him. Nicole was Rock's maid who kept his quarters clean. Francine was Rock's personal masseuse and she was in charge of bathing him while also being tasked with cooking for the whole commune as well as running the bakery. At the bottom of the hierarchy were Josie, Maurice Lambert, and Claude, who were outdoor workers with jobs like collecting firewood, feeding the animals, as well as repairing machinery. The nurse Gabrielle was obviously tasked with nursing, but also gardening, as well as an interpreter for any outsiders showing up to the commune. But Jacques' wife, Maurice Grenier, was considered to be the lowest of the low to Rock. Rock had even forbade the married couple to have intercourse and convinced Jacques that Maurice had a birthmark that resembled the symbol 666 on her stomach. Eventually, Rock made Maurice and her children live separately from the rest of the group and would not allow them to mix with anyone.
As the need for money grew, Rock decided that the group would start selling fruit and baked goods to the nearby townsfolk. They formed their own company, which Rock titled the Ant Hill Kids, because of how they worked together like a colony of busy little ants. But even with this new business venture and money coming in, Rock again turned back to alcohol during their first winter in Ontario. He complained of stomach pain again, and the only way to treat it, in his mind, was to drink alcohol. The familiar cycle started again. Rock would drink all day and begin boasting about how much money and property he had, He'd make his wives bring him his king's jewels, which in reality were just costume jewelry that he would wear around his commune while talking about how rare and valuable they were. He would then order his wives to join him in his bedroom, where he would engage in orgies while listening to Mozart and Beethoven. Rock would purposefully pit the women against each other in these sexual situations. He'd focus on two women who were close to one another and purposefully give one of them more attention than the other, usually resulting in jealousy. But it wasn't just the mental and emotional manipulation that he used. He also routinely made his followers fight each other, like actually physically. He had a stopwatch and would draw a ring in dirt in order for them to go at each other for 3 minutes straight while they were naked. Whoever won had to pick someone else to fight, and this would go on for hours. And this was just the beginning of the growing violence that Rock's cult was about to experience. As his drinking became worse, Rock would become easily angered over anything and everything. There were times when he would grab an axe and would hit whoever was closest to him with the flat side of the blade, often targeting the head or the legs. Maurice Lambert recalled a time when she was sitting at the kitchen table and Rock struck her in the head with a hammer and then refused to allow her to go to the hospital. Other than using weapons to punish his followers, he also enjoyed making them strip naked. And then, while they were lying on the floor, he would proceed to urinate into their mouths and all over their heads. Gabrielle was also made to lick another person's anus right after they had defecated and then smear feces all over her own face.
In the spring of 1984, social services in nearby Victoria County became aware that the group had settled into their region. They knew that the group had children as well as women that were expecting among them and decided they should go check in on them to make sure that they were well equipped for the upcoming colder season. So on Monday, June 25th, 1984, a group of social workers descended upon the camp. Rock greeted them, as charming as ever, and he quickly led them around and attempted to impress them by showing just how well built the buildings were and how they were able to be self-sufficient with the milling of their own lumber. The social workers left impressed and ended up closing the file. But on October 5th, 1984, a Canada-wide bulletin went out that changed the social workers' minds. The message came from Quebec authorities who were looking for information as to the whereabouts of Rock Thériault and his group as they had a baby die in their care. The Quebec authorities had a court order that gave them the power to check in on the commune to ensure that the remaining kids were safe. But the group had since disappeared from Quebec. This prompted the social services in Ontario to reopen their file and head back to the commune, this time with an OPP constable. One of the social workers, Georgia Brown, immediately noticed how docile the women were acting, and no one would talk to them without the permission of Rock. When questioned by the authorities about what had happened in Quebec, Rock brushed it all off as lies. He said in reality it was Guy Veer who had killed little Samuel, and then as a result of his guilt, Guy had asked to be castrated. It was the closed-minded Quebec authorities who wouldn't let them live in peace, so they fled to Ontario where people seemed to be more open and accepting. All they wanted was to be left in peace. Rock also informed them that all of the women were his wives and the other men on the commune were not allowed to engage in sexual activity. When asked what would happen to the young girls on the commune and if they would eventually also become his wives, Rock replied by saying that he hoped that they would. When asked how old the girls would need to be when that happened, he simply smiled, shrugged, and then walked away.
Over the next few months, a group of social workers continued to visit and even supplied the Anthill kids with supplies and food. Every time they visited, they became more and more concerned that Rock's followers were not being given enough to eat. Much later on, Georgia Brown would discover that the children were living off a diet of just corn and cabbage. They weren't routinely allowed milk, cheese, or other dairy. The feeling that something more was going on and that Rock was hiding something continued to grow for the social workers. On the morning of January 26, 1985, another tragedy occurred. Gabrielle left her 5-month-old son wrapped in a blanket outside and unattended in a wheelbarrow. He was there from approximately 9 a.m. until 10:45 a.m. And by the time Gabrielle returned, he was blue and not breathing. An ambulance eventually arrived, but it was too late. The baby was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital. the coroner concluded that the baby died of SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome. According to Gabrielle, it was mentioned that Rock held a strong animosity towards her son and frequently subjected him to physical abuse throughout his short life. Rock would express his disdain by claiming the child was a source of burden and referred to him as having the mark of Satan due to a minor deformity in one of the eyelids of the child. Gabrielle believed that it would be beneficial to everyone if the child's life came to an end. When the baby eventually passed away, Gabrielle perceived it as a merciful act and believed it would alleviate the child's suffering. Social services offered to have the child cremated, and Rock agreed to this just 2 days after the baby died. But not everyone at the office was convinced that the death wasn't intentional, George Brown being one of them. George's boss agreed with her, so COMA, or Council on Mind Abuse, was called. COMA was a nonprofit in the Toronto area that specialized in cults. After they were called, two of COMA's founders drove to meet with Georgia, where she explained the entire situation to them. When Georgia finished, one of the founders said, "I think we have ourselves a cult."
COMA's founders state that the majority of individuals recruited into cults are typically young, middle class, idealistic, and possess a curiosity for spirituality. Many of these recruits have encountered traumatic experiences such as childhood abuse, family separation, the loss of a loved one, or the inability to accomplish significant goals. It appears that these individuals are actively seeking a fresh identity that enables them to relinquish their current responsibilities and rely entirely on a self-proclaimed charismatic leader for their emotional and physical needs. Psychiatrists commonly refer to these potential converts as seekers, individuals who actively seek out mystical or fantastical beliefs to fulfill their lives. Beneath the outward humility displayed by the leader, there lies an overwhelming sense of arrogance. Possessing charisma and persuasive qualities, a remarkable leader has the power to inspire unwavering loyalty towards both themselves and their objectives. The crucial element in any cult is the skillful utilization of mind control methods, commonly referred to as brainwashing. Typically, these techniques involve isolating followers, subjecting them to prolonged periods of mental or physical exertion, such as constructing multiple communes in the harsh wilderness, depriving them of proper nutrition, as observed in this case, introducing unique rituals, implementing a group dress code, check, and incessantly reiterating the leader's doctrines through flamboyant and evangelical performances, also check. The ultimate goal of employing these techniques is to eradicate the follower's capacity for critical thinking. Loyalty is sustained through the manipulation of fear of external forces branded as malevolent by their leader, as well as fear of the leader themselves. When the founders finished telling Georgia all of this information, she immediately filed the Anthills file to be top priority. She was absolutely determined to guarantee the safety of the kids living on this commune.
In the days and weeks after the baby died in the cold, outsiders were consistently around the commune, and this led to even more paranoia for Rock Terrio. He now told his followers that they were forbidden from leaving the commune, but in October of 1985, Maurice Grenier, the woman who Rock exiled from the group, who had been living in the wilderness separate from the rest of the commune, finally left and made her way back to her parents' residence in St. Marie. Her father was shaken by her appearance, and his grandchildren, who he was meeting for the first time, crawled around on the ground on all fours. All of the children showed signs of malnutrition. Their stomachs were swollen, while the rest of their bodies were sickly thin. When authorities learned that Maurice had slipped away from the cult, they sent members of COMA to help her to adjust back to real life, and over the span of a few months, Maurice was finally ready to talk. Maurice detailed the horrors that she and the others had been subjected to under Rock's leadership. She confirmed that the children were divided into the slave children and the chosen children, depending on whether or not Rock had biologically fathered them or not. And I think you can guess which kids fell into which of these groups. Maurice told them that Rock had involved the so-called slave children in group masturbation sessions, and when he had been drinking, he would often toss these kids into the freezing lake or against trees. That's all the authorities needed to hear, and on December 6, 1985, a convoy of police vehicles made their way back out to the Anthill commune. During this raid, they took all of the children away in a school bus and handed them off to various foster families. Many of the foster families reported things being off with these kids. They noticed things like the kids being scared when someone would turn on a light or being afraid of any man with a beard. Their teeth were yellow or black, and they'd consistently rock or chant and bang on things. As some of the kids were interviewed by police, more disturbing information was coming to light. One of Rock's daughters was asked to show them what had been happening on the commune using dolls. She responded that there weren't enough dolls in the room to show them, so they got more dolls and stuffed animals for her to use. She then proceeded to tell them how all of the adults would dance in a circle with their pants off. The children would then join in and look on as the adults lay down and began touching each other in funny ways. Heartbreakingly, during a medical examination of another prepubescent girl, they discovered that her genitalia had been torn. Maurice Grenier also informed the social workers that Rock had a peculiar way of educating the children about sex. She claims that he would have young children masturbate him, explaining that it was his way of awakening the children sexually and providing education. No one was allowed to show the children any sort of affection other than Rock. However, when the children were upset or crying, he would order the parents to beat the kids. There was also talk of how he threw kids in cages or against walls, and when he would throw children into the lake, he would make the mother wait to rescue their child until, quote, the devil bobs up for the third time.
Rock would also grab two babies at the same time and hold them by their ankles over a fire while laughing and taunting the mothers, quote, I might just throw one of these babies into the flames. Which one will it be? The women would be on the ground sobbing and begging Rock to stop. On one occasion when Rock was behaving violently, Jacques attempted to put a stop to it, and this resulted in Rock grabbing a wine glass, smashing it, and using the edge to slash Jacques' throat, which severed nerves as well as his jugular vein. Jacques nearly died that night. So the evidence was piling up, and Georgia Brown was confident that all of the children would become permanent wards of the state and therefore safe from the hands of Rock Thériault. However, the court ordered an independent assessment, which suggested that the children be returned to the Anthill compound immediately. Now, this assessment is widely considered to have been a mess from the start. In charge of evaluating the children and mothers was Dr. Martine Milkovich. She interviewed all eight of Rock's wives, as well as Rock Thériault himself. She also performed tests on eight of the commune children. And her conclusion was that, quote, I could see the children were not disturbed, and I work with children all of the time. There was evidence of physical abuse, but nothing chronic. Milkovich also admitted that the children were introduced to sex at an unreasonably early age, being allowed to help during childbirth, playing with each other's genitals, and watch while the adults had sex. Quote, it was an extremely liberal sense of sexuality, but the principles behind it weren't bad. Rock Thériault would demonstrate how the penis worked by masturbating in front of the children, but he didn't do it for his own satisfaction. He did it as a form of education, and I thought that was an important distinction. We could go on with Milkovich's assessment, but I think that's about all I can stomach for right now. The judge clearly wasn't moved by her assessment either, and on October 26, 1987, 2 years after they were initially taken, the children were officially made wards of the Crown with no parental access. Shockingly, charges were never brought against Rock at this time. The assistant Crown attorney stated that there wasn't enough evidence. One OPP sergeant, Ron Deck, even went as far as to say, "Things aren't as bad as they've been made out to be," when talking to a Toronto newspaper outlet. This would end up being a massive error in judgment, and perhaps if things had been done differently, the horrors that were about to unfold could have been avoided.
Rock's violence and extremism had gone unpunished for nearly a decade now, and things were only escalating back at the compound. He was drunk more often than he was not, and during these times his followers had to walk on eggshells. He'd be set off by anything. There was no telling what would send him into a blind rage. After years of physical and mental abuse, his followers were convinced that Rock could read their minds. After Rock had drank a 2-6, or a quart for our American listeners, of cognac, he unleashed his rage on Claude. Rock decided to wrap an elastic band around Claude's testicles. Claude, in fear of his leader, kept the elastic band on all night until the following morning when his scrotum had swelled to the size of an orange and had turned blue. A month went by, and while urinating, Claude realized that his testicles had become infected. The following is a direct excerpt from the book Savage Messiah. "It felt dead," said Claude. "I ran away and hid in a cold fridge, but Rock was drinking again, and he decided to do one of his operations. He was drunk and started searching for me. Then I ran into a small outhouse, but Rock took the Jeep and began ramming it over and over until I came out. Rock ordered Claude to lie on the ground while the others held Claude's arms and legs. Rock, using a razor blade, began cutting into Claude's scrotum, eventually pulling the infected testicle out with his fingers. He then cauterized the wound with a piece of iron from the fire. But that wasn't the end. In Rock's drunken stupor, he suggested that he needed to look inside Claude's stomach as well. But before things could continue to escalate, Claude ran off into the forest where he hid until Rock sobered up. As Rock's behavior continued to increase in violence, it was not uncommon for members of the cult to run and hide in the wilderness. Sometimes they'd be out there for days at a time to avoid him.
In February of 1987, Giselle would be Rock's next target. He threw a hunting knife across the room and it ended up piercing Giselle's thigh 3 inches deep. Giselle was bleeding heavily, and Rock's reaction to this was to grab another beer from the fridge before going to bed. Giselle ended up developing a blood clot from this injury. Here's Giselle talking about what happened next. "When he did his doctor's work, he was just like a butcher. He was very rough with his patients. He took my leg and bent it, forcing the blood to shoot out from the cut. The pain was unbearable. Then he asked someone to get a file, similar to a large nail, and put it in the fire so it would get red hot. Everybody was holding me down, and he stuck the file into my leg, and I was screaming. I was trying to fight the others off. But Rock still wasn't satisfied. He boiled water for 20 minutes and asked Gabrielle to pour it onto the cut. She was shaking, and she wound up spilling 3 cups of boiling water onto my leg. The pain was so intense that I couldn't stop screaming. I passed out twice. When I came to, I couldn't recognize the people around me. It was as if I was in a concentration camp." After this, Giselle begged Jacques to take her to the hospital using the compound snowmobile, but he refused, explaining that the engine would wake Rock up. So instead, Giselle prayed that her leg would heal on its own, but it didn't. The infection came back, and Rock tried another method of treatment, this time mixing olive oil and salt and rubbing it into the wound. Giselle dealt with this pain for another month before she finally escaped by hitching a ride to a woman's shelter. She knew she should go to a hospital, but she was too afraid that the medical team would ask questions, and so, after a few days at the shelter, Giselle went back to the commune. In her words, quote, "I always went back because in my head I had to stay with my husband. The others in the group needed me too." The violence continued, and it became so expected that the group began to lose track of all the horrors they had to endure. But here's a list directly from the book Savage Messiah. There was the time he fired up the acetylene torch, and while Gabrielle held Josie tight in her arms, passed the flame back and forth over Josie's back and shoulders, roasting the flesh until the skin bubbled up. There was the time he took the torch to Nicole's stomach on the day that she gave birth to her first child. There was the time he smacked Jacques in the forehead with the blunt edge of an axe and smashed his ribs with a wooden club. There was the time he punched his son Rock Jr. in the face after he refused to fight his brother Francois. There was the time he punched and kicked Nicole in the stomach when she was 3 months pregnant, causing her to lose the baby. There was the time he fired a .303 bullet through Nicole's right shoulder. There was the time he threw Giselle to the ground, kicked her in the head, and broke her ribs with his steel-toed boots. There was the time he held Claude's right foot in his hand and bent each of the toes backwards until they snapped. There was the time he grabbed a piece of broken glass and ran the sharp edge along Claude's left arm from his shoulder down his arm, slicing it open. There was the time he took a pair of pliers and yanked 11 healthy teeth out of Claude's mouth. There was the time he ordered one of the women to strike Claude's leg with a sledgehammer, breaking it. There was the time he took a pair of vice grips and pinched Gabrielle and Giselle's nipples until they bled. There was the time he ordered Jacques to tie Claude's hands and ankles together and hung him from a beam for over an hour. There was the time that he poured boiling water over Claude's shoulders and back. There was the time he picked Claude up and sat him down on a red-hot stove, searing his buttocks. There was the time he beat the commune's workhorse to death with chains and then ordered Claude to burn the corpse. There are so many more items on this list, but the most sickening part is that his followers didn't blame Rock for the ongoing violence. In their minds, he was just following God's orders and it was their own fault for sinning and Rock was helping them. They'd even write him letters thanking him for the creative ways that he punished them. Here's a letter from Solange. "Good day, Moses, my master. I would have liked to talk to you yesterday evening, but I think it is preferable to write these things rather than saying them for fear of talking too much. I'm going to talk to you about the last fit of anger that your master exercised through you. I really believe that what you did doesn't come from you, but from someone much higher. For my part, I really believe that you were possessed by a very powerful spirit. That's what I saw in what you did. The throwing of the knife, the rifle shot, the harm done to Mommy. My eyes saw things that went beyond them. My body is very afraid of all of these things. I understand it very well because of the law of death in which it exists. But within myself, I am well. I am very well and very happy to belong to a real master, who himself belongs to the only real master of life. Love, Solange."
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What happened next to Solange is absolutely heartbreaking, especially with the provided context from that letter where we can see that she was grateful to Rock for the abuse that he was dishing out under the guise that it was coming directly from God. Leading up to these events, Rock and Solange had become very close. He placed special responsibilities on her shoulders, and from the other wives' observations, she had become Rock's favorite wife. Solange had actually confided in Giselle that she was planning on leaving the group. This was during one of Rock's drunken days when the two women decided to run and hide in the forest to wait the violence out. Solange said, quote, "I want to leave here. And when I leave, I won't be like you. When I get past the fence, I won't stop. I'll never come back." But in the fall of 1988, Solange had been feeling under the weather. When Rock caught wind of this, he began saying that there would need to be some sort of operation. He had convinced Solange that she had an issue with her liver due to what seemed to be an overindulgence of alcohol. This, of course, was Rock's diagnosis. Giselle had a feeling that things were about to escalate. As it would turn out, Giselle was right on the money, and one evening Rock took Solange by the shoulders and said, "Are you ready? I'm going to treat you tonight." She agreed, and the group began clearing the table in the bakery to prepare for the operation. After the tools had been sharpened and readied for the procedure, Rock told Solange, quote, "I'm going to relieve your liver problems, and you're going to be cured." Gabrielle acted as the nurse and prepared a solution of molasses, oil, and water. Rock began giving Solange an enema with that solution by using a homemade contraption made from a red rubber bag. Rock was quite rough and struggled getting the positioning of the bag correct, resulting in fecal matter spilling on the table. Solange was clearly in pain, and yet this went on for nearly half an hour. Rock would repeat that suffering on earth was necessary if they wanted to be in heaven with God. Rock then placed a clear tube down either Solange's nose or mouth and into her stomach and ordered everyone present in the room to either suck or blow on it. He then brought out a knife and made an incision 5 inches long on her right flank below her rib cage. He inserted his fingers inside the incision and pulled out a piece of something beige while saying, "There, you're going to be all right." The others present said that what he pulled out looked like part of an intestine. Rock took another piece, this one was a little bit bigger, about 4 inches long, and put the other piece back inside of her. This was all happening while Solange was awake and unsedated. He then proceeded to sew her up and ordered her to get up and walk around. She made her way back to the cabin and into her bed, where she lay the entire night suffering in pain. The next morning, she told the others that she didn't think it was possible for the body to handle so much pain. She was then given 2 baths. Rock stated that it would stimulate her, but in the bath, Solange's condition deteriorated and she became paralyzed. The group carried her from the bath back to her bed where she began bleeding from the mouth. Solange was dead. A doctor weighed in on what he believed the cause of death was. He thought it was acute peritonitis, which is caused by digestive chemicals leaking into the abdominal cavity and is fatal if not treated.
The group covered Solange's corpse with a blanket, and Rock ordered them to bring her to his sanctuary. He laid her down, removed his own clothes, and lay down on top of her. He then asked for the others to kill him, stating that he couldn't live without Solange, but they refused. A coffin was built for her, and Solange was buried holding her Bible. In the ensuing days, Rock attempted suicide multiple times with his followers' assistance. He tried sitting in the van with the exhaust pumping into it, but this failed. He then swallowed 2 entire bottles of Tylenol, and this failed as well. They placed him in a bathtub with his arms and his legs tied in an attempt to drown him. But Rock said a white light appeared and a strange force removed the bindings. Rock took this as a sign that God did not want him to die. A week later, Jacques made a call to Giselle, who was living back with her parents, saying that he had something important to tell her, but it wasn't safe to say it over the phone. Giselle immediately knew something horrible had happened and asked if someone had been gravely injured or killed. Jacques confirmed Giselle's fear. But when Rock called Giselle a few days later and told her that he wanted to meet her in Quebec, groveling, promising he would stop drinking and saying how badly he needed her now that Solange was dead, Giselle once again fell back under Rock's spell. He asked her to find an apartment in Quebec City, but even stranger, he told Giselle that he needed to go to Utah to speak with a psychiatrist in regards to Solange's death.
Rock and Giselle arrived in Salt Lake City, where he informed the doctor that Solange had died suddenly from a pulmonary embolism. The doctor assured him that there was nothing he could have done to save Solange and listened intently as Rock began confiding in the doctor about his experience in the aftermath of Solange's passing. Specifically, Rock was convinced that he could hear Solange in his abdomen and that Solange, from inside his abdomen, told him that she was tiny and curled up in a white room inside of his body. He often conversed with the voice inside him. He became obsessed with a version of Adam and Eve he conjured. Eve was created from Adam's rib, and so Rock believed that Solange was entering his ribs, and soon his belly would begin to swell, similar to pregnancy. The psychiatrist found this interesting, sort of a reverse birth. After Rock's meeting with the psychiatrist, he told Giselle that he was pregnant with Solange while rubbing his stomach with both hands. He said that he could feel her inside of him and could even hear her voice. When they arrived back in Ontario, Rock told his flock that he was pregnant and that Solange was growing inside of him. He also suddenly turned on Giselle, expressing that he hated her now and that it was her fault that Solange had died. He then ordered the other women to scalp Giselle, so they cut off all of her hair before Rock sliced open a vein on the scalp, leaving her devastated and bloody. Days after this, Rock ordered Claude to exhume Solange's corpse. So they removed her from the coffin, and Rock began opening up her body once more. He armed himself with rifles and knives in a likely attempt to scare the group into following his every order. And then Rock told Gabrielle to pour vinegar all over Solange's body so that the worms wouldn't enter her. He then ordered her to remove the uterus and the kidneys and place them into a jar.
After this, they reburied Solange, but just a few days later, Rock ordered them to dig her up once again. At this point, she was beginning to decompose, and the smell was obviously horrible. Rock told Jacques to look up how to perform a lobotomy, asking him to make a hole with a drill in her skull. Jacques, following Rock's orders, opened Solange's skull. His reasoning for this was that Rock wanted to masturbate into her brain. Rock would continue this pattern of burying Solange and digging her up, each time removing parts of her decaying body. Finally, Giselle would be able to get through to her husband, reminding him that Solange wanted to be cremated, and Rock eventually agreed. But before they could incinerate the body, Rock removed one of Solange's ribs, which he then wore on a leather sheath on his person as a memento. He also kept other pieces of Solange's bones in a jar with olive oil and a picture of the two of them together. Rock would also masturbate regularly into this jar, convinced that it would bring her back to life.
In the weeks and months following the death and mutilation of their fellow cult member Solange, the others were finally starting to have their doubts about their leader, Rock Thériault. Members of the group started living back and forth between the homes of relatives and returning to the commune. This perceived slight against his leadership did not bode well for the group, as Rock continued to up his violent antics as punishment for them not sticking by his side. But Gabrielle, the nurse, was Rock's next target. One evening she complained of a toothache. Rock was already inebriated and he responded, "You've always had a big mouth. Well, this will shut your mouth for good." Grabbing a pair of pliers and prying open her mouth, he ripped out 8 perfectly good teeth while completely missing the infected tooth. Gabrielle was left bloody and reeling, but Rock wasn't finished. He grabbed a knife and chased her around, threatening to stab her. Gabrielle found a knife of her own, but in the struggle between the two of them, Rock managed to slice into her wrist, severing the tendons of her hand. Gabrielle then ran off into the woods and ended up at a woman's shelter, where she explained that the cause of her injuries was her boyfriend who had punched her in the face. She received treatment from dentists and doctors for the injuries to her mouth and hand. Due to the shelter's policy of not getting law enforcement involved without the victim's consent, the police were not notified of this incident. Rock found out that Gabrielle had run off to the shelter and ended up locating her. The same old song and dance played out. He sobbed and told her that he'd stop drinking, and yet another victimized woman returned to the commune. As you might have already guessed, Rock didn't change. It only took days before he began drinking again and told Gabrielle that the doctors who fixed her hand didn't do a good enough job. He grabbed the pliers again and reopened the stitches in her hand and tore out the wires that they had placed in there to repair her severed tendons.
On the evening of July 26th, 1989, Rock was drunk and bragging to his followers about his surgical prowess and his immense wealth. This all-too-familiar scene caused some of his followers to flee into the woods, but before Gabrielle could react, Rock started to inspect her hand once again. He told her to rest her hand on the table and suddenly plunged a knife straight into the back of her hand. Knowing he had just pinned her to the table, he smirked and said, "You're not going to run tonight, huh?" He left her like that for 45 minutes, and her arm began to turn blue. Rock told Gabrielle that things weren't looking good and retrieved a curved carpet knife out of a toolbox. He thrust the blade into her upper right arm while gripping her by the shoulder. He was removing chunks of her flesh and flinging them to the floor, working his way to the bone. Somehow, Gabrielle managed to stay conscious throughout all of this. but Rock stopped, unable to finish as he was too drunk. He ordered another of his wives to pick up where he left off. Rock moved her to a stump on the property and told her to stick her arm out. He raised a cleaver over his head and swung it at her arm but missed. He succeeded in severing her arm on his second try. Gabrielle spent the entire night curled on the floor in pain, and Rock slept peacefully on the couch. After days of more torture, including another attempted escape and Rock attempting to cauterize the stump of her arm with a cast iron wrench, Gabrielle finally escaped on August 14th. She walked into the emergency department of York County Hospital with a haphazardly amputated arm, among many other injuries. The police were immediately called, and Constable Bob Bowen took charge of her case. Bob initially accused Gabrielle of lying and executed a search warrant of the commune, which he found deserted. He found sharp instruments and bloody Kleenex, but not much else. The manhunt for the other commune members, but most importantly Rock Thériault, was an arduous process that ended up taking more than 6 weeks. But eventually, they located Rock hiding just half a mile away from the commune.
Now, if you recall all the way back to the beginning of part one of this two-part series, we began our story with Gord Mangtalo, who worked as a welfare caseworker. Now, Giselle ended up under his wing, and after building a relationship with her, Giselle told Gord everything about the abuse that she and the other Ann Hill kids had endured. Knowing that the authorities were looking for Rock, Gord Mangtalo phoned Bob Bowen and informed him that he was aware of where Rock's wife Giselle was living and she was his client. Gord told Bob that he was certain that Giselle would be willing to give evidence, especially in the case of the severing of Gabrielle's arm. Gord brought Giselle to the OPP detachment after dinner time so they could take her statement. The reason they scheduled this interview late in the day is because Bob Bowen had to be present at what he believed would be a routine bail hearing. However, to everyone's surprise, all of Rock's followers, including Rock himself, pleaded guilty to all charges in relation to the amputation of Gabrielle's arm. Rock got 12 years in prison for 3 counts of aggravated assault causing bodily harm. The other cult members were convicted on 1 count of aggravated assault. Jacques got 5 years, Chantal got 2 years, and Nicole just 18 months. After Rock was sentenced, he began speaking to the media, trying to convince the public that he wasn't a monster, brushing off his actions, stating that Gabrielle's arm was simply infected. He also added that he pleaded guilty because he didn't want to cost the Canadian taxpayers tens of thousands of dollars with a trial. While Rock was attempting to clean up his image in the media again, the OPP gathered more evidence against him. Little did Rock know that Giselle had told Gord Mangtalo that there was a body on the commune. They brought in Gabrielle for more questioning, as Giselle had mentioned that Gabrielle was present for the surgery Rock performed on Solange, and that she had even assisted, thus making her an accomplice to first-degree murder. The police told Gabrielle this information, and she immediately started talking. She provided a full videotaped retelling of the homicide and even went to the compound with the police to give them a more accurate picture of the events as they had taken place. She told them all about the murder, the exhumations of Solange's body, and the mutilation done to her corpse. With the help of Gabrielle, the police began searching the grounds for Solange's remains and were eventually able to find her charred bone fragments.
On October 24, 1989, Rock Thériault was charged with first-degree murder and transferred to a maximum security prison in Kingston, Ontario. He was evaluated by a psychiatrist by the name of Andrew Malcolm, who concluded that Rock was plagued by a constellation of mental illnesses, including sexual sadism, narcissistic personality disorder, and a grandiose sense of self-importance. He also had a lack of empathy towards others. He did find that Rock Thériault was fit to stand trial. Unfortunately, the judge was unable to conclude that there was enough evidence to indicate that there was premeditation in the killing of Solange, so instead, Rock would be tried on the lesser charge of second-degree murder. His day in court would come on January 18, 1993 in Kingston, Ontario. Rock no longer had his signature scraggly beard. He appeared neat and tidy in a gray suit. the prosecuting attorney read the long list of Rock's history before offering Rock the opportunity to speak. He seized this opportunity, of course, and spoke to the court in French the following.
Distinguished lawyers, members of the court, Your Honor, these past 3 years of incarceration have induced me to a complete about-face on the storm of unusual behavior in my inner self. It is with the good faith of my inner vibrations that I come before you. I recognize that the justice system fulfilled its duty by placing me behind bars. Over several years, I made of myself an odious character, an incontestable master, compelled undetectably by my own will. The oddities and debaucheries of my way of thinking, into which I surreptitiously mixed love, hate, religion, labor, alcohol, and violence in my body's helpless state. I nourished my soul with the follies of grandeur. I have inflicted on myself mental wounds whose invisible scars I will carry for the rest of my life. Some of these scars will remain particularly vivid, such as the ones created when I carried out the folly of my fury, traumatizing, mutilating, and inflicting suffering on the members of my entourage, and most particularly the events that led to the premature death of Solange Boillard. I made a criminal of myself. Allow me to plead for clemency for those who may have put themselves at risk before the law and society by going to live in the slavery of that hell. I was the leader of that commune, and I take full responsibility for all the misdeeds committed during its existence. With dignity and a new integrity, I will serve whatever sentence the court deems suitable.
Rock would end up receiving a life sentence without the possibility of parole for 10 years. Sitting in the courtroom that day was Gabrielle, who now had a stainless steel arm, and she was aghast at how lenient Rock's sentence was. She believed he posed a massive danger to society and wanted to see him locked away for the rest of his life. The beginning of Rock's prison sentence seemed to be going well for him. He was attending English and math classes and working as a janitor. He also grew a vegetable garden and shared his bounty with his fellow inmates. The guards considered him to be a pleasant inmate who worked hard. However, things would take a turn as threats began to be made by other inmates, and he ended up being sequestered to solitary confinement for his own protection. He would spend 23 hours per day in his cell and allowed only 1 hour of solitary exercise.
Rock was moved to a different prison in the year 2000. This was a medium security prison in New Brunswick. He applied for parole in 2002, but was rejected after being deemed a high risk of reoffending, and he never applied for parole again. Finally, on February 26, 2011, Rock, now 63 years old, was found dead near his prison cell. It is believed that his death was caused by his cellmate, another convicted murderer by the name of Matthew Gerard McDonald. Matthew walked up to the guard station that day, carrying a shiv and stating, "That piece of shit is down on the range. Here's the knife. I sliced him up." Matthew Gerard McDonald received another 25 years in prison for the second-degree murder of Rock Thériault on March 5, 2012. In the aftermath of this case, Gabrielle the nurse would go on to write a book detailing her experiences. The book was titled L'Alliance de la Brebis, or The Alliance of the Sheep in English. When Gabrielle learned of the assassination of the man who had once been her husband, her initial reaction in 2011 was that the prisoner who had done it had colluded with the authorities to get rid of Rock Thériault. In an article written by La Presse, Gabrielle shares that in the years after her escape, she had been able to forgive Rock Thériault, but wants to make it clear that forgiveness doesn't mean that she granted him amnesty. She also believes that if Rock had not been killed, that he would have attempted to apply for parole again, and she would have returned back to the courtroom to make sure that he would be denied. Quote, "I would have gone there another time to oppose it. Rock Thériault was the devil. His gaze was endowed with a charisma that overwhelmed us. I'm sure I'll see him again on the other side." So even though she carried justified resentment towards Rock Thériault, she still thought that maybe the authorities had planted his murderer or colluded with his murderer in the prison system.
We weren't able to find much information about the other Ant Hill Kid members in the years that have passed since their messiah was convicted for Solange's murder. But we sincerely hope that they were able to find peace and meaning in life after the trauma and violence they endured at the hands of this monster who convinced them all that he would be their savior. That's all we have for this TNTC Plus exclusive episode. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive into one of Canada's most disturbing cult cases. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.